Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. In our era of accelerating technological complexity, organizations that build and operate mission-critical systems face an unprecedented challenge: how to transform rigid hierarchical structures into adaptive, interconnected ecosystems capable of rapid innovation while maintaining the reliability and safety that our lives depend on. This transformation requires leaders who understand both the technical intricacies of complex systems and the human dynamics of organizational change. And we have one such leader with us today. Today, we're exploring how ecosystemic thinking can revolutionize the way organizations approach digital transformation, AI governance, and systems integration. We will examine how breaking down silos and creating adaptive networks enables organizations to deliver faster, more affordably, and more effectively than ever before, while investigating the leadership approaches needed to orchestrate transformation across complex stakeholder ecosystems. I'm your host today. I'm Marco Nunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economist. My background is in policy, finance, technology, and innovation. And my expertise is really at the intersection of innovation and macroeconomics. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Carol Erickson, who's the founder and president of Erickson Mission Solutions and the former vice president of digital transformation at Northrop Grumman. Carol, first of all, thank you so much. I'm delighted to have you with us. Thank you for accepting to come on your podcast. And why I've said very little about you, but there is a lot more behind this in your background. Do you want to start by telling the audience a bit more about your professional journey?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I started my professional journey 38 years ago, it's hard to believe, as an engineer with the goal of moving from Boston to California, seeing what the aerospace industry was like and staying for a year or two. 38 years later, I'm still in California and I've spent my whole career in aerospace and defense. As I said, I started out as an engineer and quickly migrated to systems engineering and leadership. And as I rose in leadership, really seeing that intersection of technical and leadership capabilities and how they needed to come together in an organization and a team, it's been through each of my roles that I've had at Northrop Grumman. They were very, very different roles, but that intersection of systems engineering and leadership and driving innovation have been key. So I was able to lead product development. I was able to lead capture teams. I was able to lead worldwide engineering organizations and then culminating in the digital transformation. So I'm really excited to talk about the ecosystem and that important intersection of technical leadership and organizational leadership together today. I left Northrop Grumman in February of this year, and I've started my own company, Erickson Mission Solutions. And I'm really excited just to continue to bring that leadership, that technical leadership and organizational leadership to other teams to help make them be successful going forward.
That's a fantastic introduction. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of the discussion, tell us also a little bit more about the company you have just started. What does it do? What services do you offer?
Yeah, it's Erickson Mission Solutions. And one of the reasons the title is Mission Solutions is because I really want to team with organizations in aerospace and defense and help them achieve their mission. That mission can vary, but in most cases, it's exactly what we're going to be talking about today, bringing together teams and organizations to deliver systems more affordably, more effectively than ever before, and leveraging the breadth of my experience and experience of peers that I have in the industry, bringing them to teams to help them very rapidly stand up programs and execute effectively on their customers' visions.
I would say that's a fantastic offering, especially given your background. And you've already raised some of the topics that are closest to my interest, to my heart, which are the intersection of technology, leadership, human capital, organizational abilities, which are especially important today, where we are in a situation where, because of how fast the technological progress is moving, and because most of the value added actually is now found at the intersection of different disciplines, having a broader approach, an approach which is broad-ranging, it's fast, it's agile, it's ecosystemic, is more and more crucial to be successful and actually to survive in the business world. To start off with, Carol, you've had 30 years of experience in aerospace and defense. You've witnessed your organizations grappling more and more with almost, in a sense, conflicting objectives, because there is a need for speed, but there is also a need for affordability. Here's where I look at it with my economist hat on. And while companies have always, of course, strived to reduce costs, today, where governments are overburdened by debt, budgets are tight across the board. So affordability, especially in key areas like aerospace and defense, becomes even more important. So in balancing these two priorities, how have you seen organizations rethink their fundamental operating models?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to say it actually goes even beyond those two. Obviously, speed and cost are critical. But at the same time that we're seeing the need for systems to be done more affordably and faster than ever, they also have to be more effective than ever, whether it's a defense system in response to where our adversaries are going or meeting our own national desires to get to Mars. I mean, our system requirements and the capabilities that we have to perform are going up while the cost and the speed are changing in opposite directions. So it really makes it very challenging. And then you see in our environment, the whole commercialization of space, the entrance of new competitors, new businesses, billionaire-backed businesses, mm-hmm. businesses that are starting from scratch with new processes. And then you see our customers also changing. At the same time, our customers are recognizing that they, within their organizations, have to change. So it really gets to the definition of an ecosystem. We have all these different elements, the cost, the schedule, the performance, the customer requirements, the competitive environment. It's all changing all at the same time. And so it really does drive that need for that ecosystem thinking and understanding what are the elements of this ecosystem? How do we all relate together? What if one changes over here? What does it do here? What do the constraints on cost? What does it imply that we have to change in our processes in order to meet that? What do the changes in speed dictate? And then if you change one element, how does it affect the other element? So it very much drives people to that ecosystem thinking. Even if they don't recognize that what they're doing is ecosystem thinking, it really, the environment that we're in is driving everybody towards that type of mindset.
And it's quite a complex set of challenges, right? Especially for organizations which traditionally, I think everywhere in industry, but perhaps even more so in these sectors, traditionally have been focused on fairly hierarchical processes and fairly classical project management strategies. Mm-hmm. So faced with this really broad-ranging change or set of changes you've highlighted, how have you seen companies starting to change, to adapt? And I think I'll leave it to you how you want to structure the discussion and the answer, but I guess that it's a double-edged question, which on one side is, how have you seen companies react? And on the other side, how do you think companies should react? What do you see as instinctively being done right and wrong?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll try to talk about both sides of that. In terms of how companies react, I mean, certainly from my own personal experience, I saw internally how Northrop Grumman reacted, but also how many of our suppliers and competitors and the customer set reacted. And I do believe this kind of system thinking and really trying to understand what is the whole ecosystem and how do we have, what elements of that ecosystem do we have to change to meet the new paradigm? And it drove people to thinking about digital transformation and really saying, okay, for those more traditional aerospace and defense companies that have a lot of those more hierarchical processes and old paper-based manual processes, they really needed to rethink their processes, their training, their organizational approach, their management methodologies, their infrastructure, their IT infrastructure and their tools, and bringing that all together. So it wasn't one element changing at a time. It was multiple elements changing at a time. And so you saw companies doing it in different ways. In some cases, companies were saying, okay, we're going to look at this and really try to change the whole product development lifecycle end to end. Now, that was the approach that we took at Northrop. We recognized that in order to meet this new paradigm to deliver systems more affordably and faster than ever, we really needed to change not only the whole product development lifecycle, but we needed to change our back office processes, our business management and financial processes so that they could keep up with the scale of the business and where we were headed. So it became a major top-down change initiative. And again, kind of looking at that end-to-end life cycle and seeing what had to change in engineering, what had to change in manufacturing and supply chain and business management, program management, in order to enable the new way of doing business. And it also required a big focus on culture change, especially when you have these old ways of doing business, these old organizational processes, that often becomes the biggest challenge. And so when you talk about what are the stumbling blocks and where have people been challenged, I think one of the biggest stumbling blocks, and nobody has a secret recipe to how to fix it, is overcoming that culture change and really getting the buy-in from the top down and from the bottom up that you need to change. And getting that incremental change and then kind of seeing the benefits of the change. And I think once you start to see the benefits, then the culture change becomes easier. But there is certainly a big culture change hurdle at the beginning that almost any organization faces.
It's very tough. A lot of the things you're telling me resonate with my experience at GE, where it was both an ecosystemic challenge and a digital challenge at the same time. Mm-hmm. The digital challenge, I think, in GE was the one that perhaps stood out more because the company was traditionally based on actual physical engineering and the excellence of the mechanics of the products. But we faced exactly what the cultural transition problem that you are describing, with a lot of resistance at the beginning and then gradually the winning over process. It also raises a question. In the case of a digital transformation by itself, I'm thinking of the digital industrial revolution, or what we at GE used to call the industrial internet, there was a clash between two different views. One view was you want to do the digital transformation, you have to start small, do pilots, make sure you learn, and then you can scale it across the organization. And the opposite view was, no, this is never going to work. You have to take a systemic approach and launch it throughout the organization. So I guess I have two questions for you on this. One, for digital transformation, which of the two strategies do you think is right? And second, when it comes to the broader set of ecosystemic challenges, do companies actually have a choice? Is it even possible to start small?
Yeah. Well, I think my answer to the first question is going to give a good lead into what my answer to the second question is, because I really think you need to do both. You really need to understand the full vision and what's that full magnitude of transformation that's needed to achieve the objectives of the company. And once you understand that full vision, you absolutely need smaller bites at that pie, and you need pilots, and you need early successes, and you need to demonstrate the value. You need to do that in kind of bite-sized pieces while you're keeping the long-term roadmap and the long-term vision in place. And you really, it gets down to this kind of system engineering view of the world. If you understand those big requirements of what needs to change, there's going to be some big rocks and little rocks. And you need to be addressing both, because those big rocks are going to take multiple years to change. And it's going to be very painful in many cases to the business. There's going to be interruptions to the business. There's going to be downtime on critical machines or critical processes. And you need to understand and plan out when that's going to happen and how it's going to happen and work those long-term projects. But in parallel, be working the smaller things that you can do and demonstrate value and get change into the hands of the employees quickly while you're waiting for those bigger changes to come. So I absolutely think it needs to be a combination of both. Both are critical. And there's also a timing of things. One of the things we saw at Northrop Grumman, digital transformation has been happening for a long time. It's not new. We talk about the advent of like model-based systems engineering, or even bringing in CAD design into our design processes decades ago. And what we had when we looked back, like around the 2020 timeframe, we had pockets of excellence across the company where digital transformation was happening. And those were, in many cases, they were the small pilots. They were getting successful capabilities into the hands of their teams. But also in many cases, we were duplicating efforts across the board because one pilot in one part of the organization didn't understand the what was happening in the other part of the organization. So really, at that point in time, we recognized because of the magnitude of the change that we needed to make, and because we started to see this duplication of effort across the board, it really made more sense to bring together an integrated effort to define the five-year roadmap, to get the teams working on that, but make sure as we did it, we didn't stop those quick successes from happening.
That's an excellent, excellent insight. And it tempts me to follow up with a question, which is perhaps unfair because it's even harder. And it's the other challenge that is related to this, Carol, is companies. And again, we saw this, we felt this very personally at GE. Companies need to invest in the new processes and the new technologies. They need to start doing things differently, develop different products in different ways with new product development cycles, move into different markets, become a different company in a sense. Mm-hmm. That requires investment. It requires setting up a different set of activity. At the same time, you still have to report your earnings every quarter. So you still have to try to keep the machine running and keep the flow of revenue going and keep things under control. And it's, and on top of this, as you invest more in the new technologies, you need to show the ROI for the investments. So what are your thoughts on this additional complicated set of issues?
Yes. It's the challenges associated with digital transformation. That's one of the things that I thought was so fun about it and why I loved leading digital transformation, because there were so many different elements of the problem. And you're exactly right. There is no appetite either for impacting your financial reporting or for impacting your product development and your delivery to your customers. So you really have to find that balance of change, right? And that's where bringing in the experts who understand the processes and know if you change a tool or change a process, change an infrastructure, what is that impact going to have on the team and on the delivery that they have? And what's the schedule impact going to be? What's the technical impact going to be? And how can you plan out and deploy the changes while minimizing the impacts on the ongoing operations? It is a very, very difficult balance. And it's probably one of the reasons why a lot of digital transformations are slow. It's not an overnight snap your fingers and we're transformed. It's a multi-year journey. It is a large investment, as you mentioned, often to reach that final destination. It takes patience and persistence. It takes really, you know, well-informed team members, I think, is the key, bringing in the right disciplines that do understand the digital tools, the digital technologies, the benefits that they can bring to the business. But then teaming them with your IT experts and your infrastructure experts, teaming them with your business management and finance team who can help you understand and estimate the value. It's again, like an ecosystem of a team. It's all these different disciplines coming together to really make the digital transformation a success.
Indeed. And in terms of bringing in transformative new technologies and the challenges that this implies, the latest example, the talk now is all about artificial intelligence. Now, this is, the hype is partly, of course, because generative AI models have brought the idea of AI in everybody's pocket. And so we're talking about it a lot, often without acknowledging the fact that artificial intelligence solutions in the more classic machine learning style have been around and have been used and deployed for quite a long time. But there are a couple of aspects. Now the excitement about AI seems to have accelerated investment and deployment in a number of organizations. And certainly the desire or the perception of a need to accelerate investment in artificial intelligence. This leads me to a couple of questions I wanted to ask you. One is, how do you see the challenge? Every new technology, and I think artificial intelligence in particular, brings new risks, which often we discover only as the technology gets deployed, especially as if the technology is still evolving rapidly. So the first question I would have, Carol, is what are your thoughts on what companies can do to balance the potential for rapid deployment of a technology like artificial intelligence, and so reaping the gains, while at the same time continuing to ensure reliability, safety, and therefore managing the risks for all stakeholders involved?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And it's something I think every organization is really grappling with right now. I really think it comes down to the fundamentals, though. And just like when you're developing a very complex space system or a manned aircraft, right? The requirements for safety have to be balanced with the requirements for performance, the requirements for cost and schedule. It all has to come together. So if you take those same principles that you use to design those systems, your strong systems engineering to understand what are we trying to affect with our artificial intelligence? Where are we going to apply it in the business? Then how are we going to apply it in the business? What do we need to change in order to really leverage and see these benefits? But then probably most importantly, a risk management and a governance framework so that you can understand the risks, you can start to build in the right safety. And I think that's probably the hardest problem right now is what is that right level of safety for artificial intelligence? But it's really kind of a unique balance where you, in my view, you want to leverage all those strengths of our traditional processes, this traditional safety engineering, risk management, systems engineering, and marry those with the innovation that's coming from the development, rapid acceleration of AI. And when you can bring those two kind of different worlds together successfully, I think that's going to make the organization most successful in being able to very rapidly deploy very powerful and innovative and successful AI solutions.
It's very true. You said something at the beginning of your answer, Carol, which I think is hugely important when you mentioned the importance of asking yourself as an organization, what do I actually want to do with artificial intelligence? What problem do I want to solve? So it's really the understanding of what this technology can potentially do and what it can do for you. Because often what I see in organizations is, I blame this partly on the gap between hype and information, but almost a reaction that says, well, artificial intelligence now can do everything. So How many benefits can we get across the board instead of, and sometimes it's a struggle to get them to narrow down and focus on, let's understand of all the things we're doing, where can it really help and why?
Yes. And it gets down to the same questions people asked about digital transformation. What's the value? What's the benefit that it's going to bring? What's the investment that it's going to take in order to get there? In many cases, to see the benefit of AI, you need to have some of this digital infrastructure, the quality of the data, all present first in order to really reap the benefits of AI. But I think the same questions that we asked ourselves as we were starting the digital transformation journey is what you have to ask yourself as we go down this AI journey. And as we've talked about too, being adaptable and answering those questions today, what can AI do for me today? What do we think the long-term vision is? What are those quick successes that we can get along the way? But what do we have to keep investing in and changing in order to continue to reap the benefits? Because obviously the landscape's changing very quickly too. So it's not like you can answer that question today and know that it's going to be the right answer next year at the same time.
And you mentioned something else which is very important, which is the quality of the data. It's something that I'm very sensitive to. You've probably seen in the papers over the past several weeks, and our audience will have too, the debates on huge revisions to some of the key macroeconomic data, from the number of jobs to inflation. And it's almost eye-opening because we take, certainly in the economic realm, we take these numbers and these concepts for granted. We talk about employment, we talk about inflation, we talk about growth. Then you take a closer look at the numbers and you realize that a lot of these numbers are actually just survey responses, which are dropping in numbers. And so this data that we think are so representative are actually of spectacularly poor quality. Now, at the macro level for a country, that's of course an extreme. But I think even within companies, there is going to be a spectrum of quality of data, right? Some data, some engineering data will be very precise, very well measured, very reliable. And then further out, we will have some data that are less so. So your point about being aware of the quality of the data when we feed them through artificial intelligence in terms of our expectations for what we can get, I think is also crucial.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think from what I've seen from digital transformation and AI adoption, the teams that really recognize that importance of data up front, and especially teams that have a long legacy, very different, diverse organizations and infrastructure, probably have very diverse data structures, and really trying to tackle the complexities of that at the same time that you're putting in the digital infrastructure and planning the future for AI. It all has to come together from the start.
The other key question I had for you on this, Carol, is the following. Is the intersection of human and artificial intelligence, which is becoming more and more important as artificial intelligence is deployed across organizations. So we're building intelligent ecosystems where, in principle, we should have both human and artificial intelligence collaborating. So it sounds all very well, but now I don't play well with the artificial intelligence tools I have at my disposal. And I'm in my own little universe. In a company, what are your guiding principles for building these hybrid intelligence networks?
Yeah, I think it really gets down to that similarity again. The interface between man and machine and the understanding of requirements and what the man can do, or the female or woman can do, and the machine, and what are the limits on both sides. We have to grapple with that all the time when you're designing space systems, when you're designing manned aircraft. You know, you really need to understand what can be autonomous and what can't be autonomous, and where are the critical checkpoints? Where do you need to build that human interaction in so that you can have a trusted system? And so understanding that and trying to define those checkpoints up front is critical. Again, learning and adapting as you go and adjusting the checkpoints as you learn more about that interface with AI is important. Also, just last night, I saw a very interesting lecture from a professor at Notre Dame, and he's working on something called the Common, I'm going to make sure I get the word right. I think it's called the Common Good Framework. And if you look back, as you had mentioned, artificial has been around for decades. Artificial intelligence has been around for decades. And one of the things that DARPA put into place decades ago was something called the Common Test Framework. And that's been a framework that every single company who's developed everything from the early neural networks up to today's large language models have leveraged that Common Test Framework. And it's part of what's led to the success and the ability to scale artificial intelligence as we see it today. And so at Notre Dame, they're working on something called the Common Good Framework. And it's trying to kind of marry that Common Test Framework with an approach that looks at the ethics of AI and looks at the trust of the systems and where do you need to have guardrails in place. Yeah. So that's early in research right now, but I'm excited to see where that goes in the future. I think those types of frameworks will be really beneficial to us going forward.
And this, I guess, it's almost a two-level challenge, I want to say. Tell me if I'm correct or completely wrong. There's one level of challenge in terms of the common good, which is the, as you said, the trust, the truthfulness of these models. So, which then in a business organization environment becomes also an issue of accuracy and reliability. To what extent can we trust these models? That is going to be crucial for performance. And then you have the broader theme, the second level of almost ethical alignment. You have the alignment problem, the ethical problems that AI can raise in terms of biases, in terms of potential unwanted, unintended consequences. So this common good, is it, do you see it as a framework that can gradually help us address these different levels of challenges in deployment of AI?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the goal. Yes.
Excellent. This is encouraging. Being economics is the dismal science, so I tend to be pessimistic, so I'm very worried. So you have cheered me up to some extent. Carol, I want to open up the lens. We've talked a lot about the challenges almost limited to one organization within an organization in terms of processes, deployment of innovation, in terms of marrying artificial intelligence with human intelligence. But we started off talking about the importance of an ecosystemic approach across different disciplines and across different systems. Now, here I think there is a trade-off that opens up between collaboration and competition, which is probably relevant certainly in the external ecosystem. So you mentioned the importance of looking at the ecosystems with our suppliers, our customers, our regulators. At the same time, there is going to be an internal ecosystem of different teams within the organization. So tell us a bit, both internally and externally, what do you think are the right strategies to strike the right balance between collaboration and competition? Or is it not an issue of balance, is it an issue of swinging a bit between one extreme and the other with sufficient frequency?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think it's an issue of balance. I always think that there's some level of healthy competition that is a very good thing that drives performance, but it absolutely has to be healthy competition. And that's where that balance comes in, because if the competition gets too far swung in one direction, then it just leads to adverse behaviors. So certainly having that balanced competition is key. I think, and there's some certain commonalities between internally and externally in terms of how you get there. But it really starts with that common vision. What is the vision of the team? And you talk about these complex teams with multiple sub-teams. And again, kind of bringing in this systems engineering approach and an understanding of the enterprise architecture. So you, the vision of the team, you're all working towards that same big goal, that North Star. You understand what each element of the team brings and what are they doing that's contributing. You understand the interfaces between the teams and the data handoffs and the timing of those and when those have to happen. And then you have a culture of communication and collaboration where the teams frequently come together, they communicate, they're willing to talk about issues. When issues are raised, they're not shot down, right? They're talked about, and you find a way to talk about how can you solve these problems collectively together as a team. And I've really found that when you do that, when you have that vision, when your leaders set that kind of lead by example, and they show that they're going to work with their peers and they're going to help each sub-team kind of achieve their goals. And then you see that ripple down into all levels of the organization. And then if you see a bad player in the organization, correct that behavior right away. If you see somebody being overly competitive, being overly protective of their team, make sure that that behavior is not really accepted. So that's kind of my view of internally. And externally, it's not all that different. You don't have as much control externally as you do internally, but it absolutely has to start with that common vision. What are we coming together collectively to do? What is that North Star? And then what can each of us bring? What are we going to do? In many cases, it's setting those expectations for collaboration and the processes to enable collaboration and the infrastructure to enable collaboration. Having that established up front to make it easy for the teams to operate across external boundaries, and then making sure you have those kind of continual checkpoints to make sure the partnership is going well and really working that at all levels of the ecosystem. So they're very, very similar approaches, but just slightly different, because you have to take different approaches with external versus internal, but very similar philosophies.
Carol, is there a bigger alignment problem in the case of external networks at the beginning, in the following sense? So within an organization, if you and I are in the same company, The directions will come down from the top. There will be some persuasion from the bottom. But in the end, we know, even if you and I are in different teams, we do know that we both depend on the profitability of the same company. So we both depend on the same final number in the bottom line of the financial accounts. But if we are in different companies, if I am your supplier or your customer, we might be at different stages of persuasion as to whether this transformation can be beneficial for us as an ecosystem or for each one of us as an individual company. Is this kind of potential disalignment an issue that arises? And if so, what are the best ways to address it?
Yes, absolutely. That issue arises. I'll talk about the easiest way to resolve it, which is when you have a united customer. So let's say we're developing a system for the Air Force and the Air Force is dictating that we go to a more digital approach and leverage AI. And it's going to require a level of infrastructure changes and behavioral changes between companies for these big systems. Seeing that bigger view that's coming from your end customer, it often can help to align across those differences, but there's always going to be different business motivations for those companies, regardless of having that common vision. So that common vision absolutely helps, but it doesn't solve all the problems. And a lot of times the problems are both different financial or business objectives, as well as different physical IT infrastructure, different processes, different talent in the companies. So there's a wide range of differences. Having an alignment and communication across the teams at all levels, again, so you can have your engineers talking to engineers across the companies, your business management talking to business management, executives talking to executives, and really having that alignment of communication. And again, that culture where, okay, we recognizing we have different objectives, but this is where we come together. This is our common, kind of to use that phrase again, the common good, but what's the common good that we're coming together as a team? And so it works best when you recognize what the differences are, acknowledge that those are there, but then find that common approach and then say, okay, in order to reach that common goal, what do we have to change? Is it going to drive infrastructure changes on one place or the other? If that's going to happen, that's going to take investment. Can the company afford to invest that much? If not, can the larger company help? There's all sorts of different conversations that have to happen once you understand what you have to do collectively together. And then again, kind of that systems engineering approach. Okay, what do we need to change in order to reach that common goal?
I love your constant references to the system engineering approach. I think it gives an excellent framework. I'm going to ask you a broad question on something which I think is very relevant today, and it's the following. So we've talked about the ecosystemic approach in general for companies and how important it is because of the broader balance or the broader range of innovation, resources, talent. Now, at the same time, we are in a geopolitical environment which tends towards fragmentation. We're seeing more geopolitical fragmentation. We've seen trade tensions that have been intensifying for the last 10, 15 years. I've seen a chart recently from the IMF showing the rapid rise of trade and non-trade barriers literally over the last 15 years. So this is a long ongoing process. We've seen several sets of shocks to supply chains, to supply chain disruptions. And we're talking about your experience, which is in sectors like defense and aerospace, which for strategic, sometimes national security reasons, are especially sensitive to some of these geopolitical considerations. So my broad question to you is, this new geopolitical environment we're in, how have you seen it impacting the sectors of defense and aerospace? And how do you see it intersecting and balancing with the ecosystemic approach? What becomes different?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is just urgency. There's always been a sense of urgency and a sense of mission importance in the aerospace and defense industry. Almost any individual person, any company, their motivating factor is the missions and the importance of what we do from a defense perspective. But with the geopolitical environment, with the changes that are happening, across the world, with the challenges that are happening across the world, there is more urgency than ever to be successful in our missions. Yeah. So people understand that change has to happen. We have to find new ways of doing business. We have to break down these barriers. In some ways, we have to be a little bit insensitive to what's happening in the world around us and say, okay, we're not going to let the behavior that's happening between political parties or between different organizations, we're not going to allow that to change our behavior. We recognize the importance of collaboration, the importance of an ecosystem thinking, the importance of each partner having an important and understandable role in that ecosystem. And we're going to continue to drive that and to change the way we do business and to deliver these systems more effectively, more affordably, faster than ever, because it's more important than ever. So it really has driven us a real sense of urgency and importance across the industry.
That's an excellent message, and especially the idea of, in a sense, ignoring the noise. So ignoring things which might be important, are important, but are not central to the mission of the company and to what needs to get done. And so focusing on the sense of urgency, I think it's an excellent, excellent message. Carol, we've had a fantastic conversation. I want to be respectful of your time, but I also want to give you, I have certainly learned a lot, and I'm sure our audience has as well. But before I leave you, I want to give you the chance. Is there something that we have not covered and we should have, or something that you definitely want our audience to take away from this conversation?
I think we've covered a lot of ground here, so I really can't think of anything that we haven't covered yet. And I know these messages have come across clearly as we've gone through the discussion, but I truly believe in the importance of having this very, I'm going to call it methodical, combination of systems engineering thinking, program management thinking, team leadership, and bringing those three together and really leveraging the benefit of ecosystem thinking and thinking big picture, understanding the elements that each part of the team bring together. I really do believe that when you do that and marry it with a culture of innovation and a willingness to change and a willingness to continually change, not get married to one particular change, but continually to change and evolve as you go. I really believe this ecosystem thinking and this approach, bringing together those fundamental practices, really will enable teams to reach that challenge, delivering our systems faster, delivering them more affordably, more effectively than ever before. I think this ecosystem thinking is critically important. So I'm really thrilled to see this podcast series and the focus that it has on ecosystem and innovation, because I really feel like it's just critical for our companies and our teams to be successful going forward.
And you are definitely one of the best experts and the champions of this approach. So it's been a real pleasure to have you on our podcast. Carol Erickson, founder and president of Erickson Mission Solutions. Thank you so much for being with us on the podcast today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us today as we explored again how ecosystemic thinking can transform mission-critical organizations into adaptive, resilient networks capable of delivering exceptional results under extreme pressure and, as we've heard, under more and more urgency. Please check out this season's other episodes as we continue examining the leadership approaches and design principles that will define organizational success in our rapidly evolving world. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is.